I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Christine Todd Whitman became New Jersey's first female governor in 1993, and during her 7 years in Trenton, she created 400,000 new jobs. Then, in December 2000, President Bush named her as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, where she worked to cut off-road diesel emissions and to remove PCBs from the Hudson River. But being a moderate in the Bush White House wasn't easy, and she resigned after just 28 months. She's called her new book about life in a changing Republican Party, It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. It is published by Penguin Press. I'm very pleased it has brought her to my show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. Monday was the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and it was marked by the annual pro-life protests outside the White House. Mm-hmm. Is abortion still a divisive issue within the Republican Party?
Unfortunately, it still is. We've seen it, a very recent example of it, when the new Republican national chairman appointed Joanne Davidson, who had been Speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives, had been a coordinator for the president in that crucial state of Ohio, had done a great deal to deliver the state for him. Ken Mellman appointed her as co-chair of the Republican National Committee and unleashed just a furor of emails and opposition because she happens to be pro-choice. And finally, the president had to step in to ensure that she could be confirmed. And she had to agree not to appear before any pro-choice fundraising groups. And, you know, it's the kind of muzzling that is contrary to my feelings about the party.
But this is not just the Republican Party now. Democrats like Hillary Clinton are talking about finding a middle ground on the issue, and many people say that the Democrats have made a big mistake in remaining pro-choice. Do you think there is such a thing as a middle ground?
Oh, absolutely. And I have talked to more people who are pro-life but recognize that in the case of rape or incest, there's room for some exceptions. I don't know anybody who's pro-abortion. And where we all, and it's something that as governor I promoted a lot of expenditure on abstinence programs. That's the only absolute way to make sure that you don't have an unwanted pregnancy or socially transmitted disease. My only point is you can start your sex education with abstinence. You can end it with abstinence. But you shouldn't just teach abstinence because, unfortunately,
it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen for a lot of kids. You can encourage it, but you don't end it there. And so there is a lot of middle ground where we can come together and really make a difference.
What other issues have been used to drive the GOP to the right, do you think?
Well, we see now that there is ever-increasing series of litmus tests that say you have to be absolutely with us on this issue. For instance, you can have no discussion of embryonic stem cells. There's just no room for that, and be a good Republican in the mind of many people. You can't, if you believe that there is a federal government role to protect the environment, that means you're not a good Republican. If you believe that the Constitution shouldn't be used to ban gay marriages, would only be the second time ever we've amended the Constitution to restrict individual freedoms. But if you believe that that's not the proper tool, you're not a good Republican, according to these people.
Arlen Specter, who has been a strong supporter of the president's policies and also played a major role in getting Clarence Thomas confirmed, suddenly became the victim of this kind of lockstep thinking.
Exactly. And the really troubling part about that is not only to go after him to send a message, they were very clear, and his opponent and those who supported him said this is about sending a message to the other rhinos, Republicans in name only, like him in the Senate, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, they named them, that if they don't get in line, they're next.
Well, hasn't the Republican Party always said that it was a big tent? What happened?
Well, that's my concern. That's the party in which I grew up, that we were, my father always referred to it as an umbrella party because you had a core set of principles that held you together and then a lot of different interpretations. And that was the party in which I grew up. And that's, I believe, the way you really maintain yourself as a national party. As Ronald Reagan said, you don't become a majority party by looking for people with whom you disagree and with whom you won't work. It doesn't make sense.
But the things actually started to change during his presidency. Before that, we talked about Eisenhower Republicans as opposed to Taft Republicans. Later, it became the Rockefeller wing. Mm-hmm. He came under attack as well when he was named to the vice presidency. A lot of conservatives even thought that he was too far to the left.
Well, the interesting thing is today, if you look back, Barry Goldwater would not be a conservative by the definition of these, well, I identify as social fundamentalists, to separate them out from real conservatives. Real conservatives, they believe passionately in issues, but they also are open to other people who might interpret it differently. But these, this group that has this litmus test, I refer to as social fundamentalists. And Barry Goldwater was pro-choice. Barry Goldwater was not gay against gays in the military. He would not have qualified. He'd be a moderate today.
Like George Bush, your parents and grandparents were very involved in the Republican Party. Was it only natural for you to follow suit?
Oh, it was to a certain degree. I mean, kids always, you either take the diametrically opposed position of your parents or you agree with your parents. I agreed
or,
up
or
to
Or today a, there's a third road, which is to ignore politics
altogether.
Well,
to ignore it entirely. And I was too fascinated by it. Because it was a people business, you can never get bored. And the subject matter ranged from education to the environment to criminal justice. So you could, it was just the kind of thing that engaged you from the beginning. But, you know, I look at the party of my parents, and I took a time when I was about 13 and said, okay, am I with this party because of my parents only, or do I actually believe in some of the things? Is there a reason not to be at that point in time? It was during the Kennedy years, which were Camelot, and most of my contemporaries were enamored of John Kennedy. And so I had to take some time to think, why was I being the outlier here?
You have been to every Republican convention since 1956 when you were 9 years old. And
I was going to say I was a baby, but it's okay. You can
say I was nine.
You can admit I was nine.
It still makes you younger than me. Eisenhower was running for re-election. What has changed about the conventions over the years?
Well, back in those days, and really it was the previous convention, 52, that was the last probably most contested election. But even in 64, there were real battles that went on at conventions. You didn't have the primary system that you have today. And so what happened at the convention actually mattered. Party chairman could deliver results and could deliver votes in a way that you don't have now. So they were very exciting. There was a lot going on. Now, whether it was for good or ill, you can argue that it's much better now. But I wonder whether we really need to spend so much money on conventions nowadays.
Since they are pretty much already
they're all predetermined.
Preordained. Yeah. And on top of it all, they present the face that isn't necessarily the real party face. Last year's Republican convention featured moderate speakers every night, or the one exception, Zell Miller, a Democrat.
Right.
But do you think that that was an attempt to attract more moderate voters? It doesn't
seem
to have mattered, has it?
It absolutely was, and it represented a real part of the Republican Party. It wasn't just a facade. Those are proud elected Republican office holders who represent a huge number of people in this country. When you take California with Arnold Schwarzenegger, you take George Pataki here in New York, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, these are legitimate Republican office holders who bear the title of Republican proudly. So it's not just on the surface. I think they're in fact reflective of more of the party than what we are hearing about. But it was clearly an effort to put that, remind people that moderates are part of the party. And the president came out of it with an 11-point bump, when the polls had been dead even up to that, in spite of the expenditure of huge amounts of money.
Well, do you think that Zell Miller was your counterpart in the Democratic Party, the old Dixiecrat conservative who feels like he is being pushed out of his party?
Well, I mean, again, I refuse to feel being pushed out of the party. I've pushed back pretty hard. But Zell obviously is speaking to a trend that is occurring on the – both parties are moving more to their extremes. And it is clear, if you look at the voting record of the leadership in the House and Senate on the Democrat side, those are very liberal voting records. So it's happening in both parties, and he's certainly representing that frustration.
I know you said you liked his book, but were you surprised when he challenged Chris Matthews to a duel?
I was surprised at that, although after his speech, I wouldn't be surprised at anything. I just hadn't seen that side of him before.
I was surprised that Aaron Burr then didn't jump up and say, hey, I'm ready. The Republican Party has had a hard time attracting black voters. What can Republicans do to reach out to them? I know,
well,
they picked up a bit of the black vote.
The president
in the
did
last
a little
election.
Bit better than he had done in the first
Mostly
one.
Mostly on abortion, still, in fact, and a couple of other gay
and the appeal
gay
to the churches really is what brought a lot in. You know, the Republican Party has a long and very proud history of supporting civil rights. In fact, civil rights legislation wouldn't have passed if it hadn't been for Republicans breaking the Democratic filibuster. So if you look back at the implementation of the Brown versus the Board of Education and other major civil rights cornerstones, if you look at who was supporting it, it was Republicans. And we need to go back to that tradition. We need to not be embarrassed about it, and we need to reach out to people.
But blacks today see the old Dixiecrat South as being solidly Republican, mm-hmm. that they see the Democrats as the party that fights for their rights, and many people have faulted the Democrats for throwing in their lot too much with minority rights and the like. So how do these things get worked out?
I would argue that from the perspective of an African American or a black voter, I have been taken for granted by the Democratic Party for too long. They assume that I'm going to be in their corner. Al Sharpton said that during this last election campaign. He said, we better be careful because we are being taken for granted. And that doesn't serve anybody's interests or needs. But the Republican Party should be the natural home of anybody who wants to be respected as an individual, wants to be given the tools to be able to succeed. You know, the president talks about an ownership society. You can agree or disagree with certain aspects of it, but that is something that is a core philosophy of Republicans, enabling the individual to take control of their lives.
This is something that you've been talking about for a long time. Didn't you issue or participate in putting together a report in the late 60s, was it, that talked about bringing more blacks into the Republican Party?
Well, actually, it was something called the Listening Program, a program that I helped get started for the Republican National Committee, and it talked to groups of blacks and of college students and of senior citizens. I went out and asked them why they were they members of a political party, and if they were, which party, and if they weren't members of the Republican Party, why not, and what issues concerned them most about the political process and what would they look for in a party, and translated that back to the Republican National Committee saying, we have real opportunities here, particularly among African Americans, but you got to reach out to them and let them know you care.
And why do you think no one actually paid much attention to that?
Well, Rog Morton at the time did, and we did do a lot of research. I think it's been perceived now most recently that it's not worth the effort, because you can put so much time into reaching out to the community and still not be able to get the kind of votes back that when you're spending this kind of money and your time is precious, people say don't bother.
And the Republican Party has done pretty well appealing to angry white males, as they've been called.
Yeah, for the moment, but I'm not sure it's sustainable. That's my concern.
Christine Todd Whitman is my guest. Her book, It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. It's published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this.
WNYC is supported by the Newark Museum, presenting through September 4th In the American Grain, featuring masters of 20th century American modern art, including Dove, Hartley, Marin, O'Keefe, and Stiglitz, organized by the Phillips Collection, Washington, D.C. More at newarkmuseum.org. WNYC is the radio partner of the Celebrate Brooklyn Performing Arts Festival. This week, Laurie Berkner, a kung fu film with live DJs, and more, free at the Prospect Park Bandshell. Details at celebratebrooklyn.org.
New York is America's international city. World events are keenly felt. For a more complete worldview, you need to see it through many different lenses. At WNYC, you get news from NPR, the BBC, and the WNYC Newsroom. A diversity of voices, a range of views, made possible through listener support. You know WNYC reflects your values and interests. That's why we can say, WNYC, it's worth your support.
Today we kick off a special summer reading series on great books that either were once well-known but no longer, or may be famous elsewhere but are relatively unknown in the United States. Plus, the life of a Jew from the Caucasus who styled himself a Muslim prince, and a peek inside what really goes on at Disney. That's all coming up on this special July 4th edition of our show on WNYC 93.9, AMA 20, and WNYC.org, now available as a podcast, too. And this is WNYC 93.9, AMA 20. We're online at WNYC.org. My guest is Christine Todd Whitman. Her book, It's My Party, Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. It's published by Penguin. You were talking about the ownership society, and right now the president's Social Security plan is facing a lot of opposition in the Republican Party. In fact, there have been a number of commentators who have talked about how he's going to have a rougher time because of opposition from within the party, both on the left and the right. So do you think that perhaps this next 4 years will play some part in determining the future of the Republican Party?
Absolutely. I think the president is going to have a more difficult time because of some of the people that put an ideological litmus test on things. It's not so much to disagree with whether or not you should be able to have a private pension, you know, direct some of your monies privately into a pension system or your own savings account. That offends me of people who object to the president. It's people who say they won't support, just out of hand, they won't support what the president wants to do on Social Security unless he becomes more active in supporting a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. Now, those two things just they're not the same thing. It's irresponsible, I believe, to the public to have that kind of a quid pro quo.
But hasn't Congress always stuck things that have nothing to do with the bill at hand into it? I mean, that's all been part of the deal-making of Washington. The Homeland Security bill has all sorts of things about the pharmaceutical industry and things that have nothing to do with Homeland Security.
No, you're absolutely right. But this is the first time we have seen such an in-your-face, you deliver for us on this or we're not going to support you on something. You know, when you talk about Social Security and the need to address the issues, it's pretty critical. And you need to at least decide whether it is critical or whether you want to direct your attention at Medicaid and Medicare. But, you know, we need to have these discussions and to say, I'm just not even going to discuss it unless you support the constitutional ban is a very narrow test that is detrimental to the future of the country.
Well, litmus tests have become a part of American political scene. You had a weird experience with Bill Bradley. He worked for you at one point. Didn't he?
Well, that's a little bit of a stretch. No, we were both at the Office of Economic Opportunity, and he came in as a summer intern, and I was a full-time employee there. So I like to think he was working for me because he was assigned to the same area.
And then later he beat you for the Senate.
He did, but not by much, which startled him, I think.
Well, that's another thing that we can talk about for a moment, because as Daniel Okrent pointed out just the other day, statistics can be misleading. So whenever people say that George W. Bush won with the greatest number of votes in the history of the United States, people rarely mention that the people opposing him, there was the largest number of people who voted against a sitting president ever in the history of the United States. We are in a very divided country right now.
It was the smallest margin of victory for any incumbent president. I mean, Truman beat Dewey by more. He beat him by almost 5 percentage points, and the president only won re-election by less than 3. It's not to take away from the fact that he won an important election, and anything after 2000 of any distance is looking very good, and he brought in some members of the House and Senate. But what's really interesting is if you look at how the country divides on the legislative side, there are 49 states that have bicameral partisan legislatures. Nebraska has the only one that's unicameral nonpartisan. Of those 49, if you look at the lower house, the assemblies, you have 25 are controlled by Republicans, 24 by Democrats. The Senates, the state Senates, it's exact opposite. And when you look, there are 7,315 state legislators across the country. The difference between Republicans and Democrats is 4 seats. That's about as close as you can get. And to me, that says that the country as a whole is much closer together than these extremes on the parties would have you believe and have us believe and the rhetoric would have us believe. And you've got about when people are asked to self-identify, are you moderate, liberal, conservative, 40% identify themselves as moderates. And again, that tells you this is an important segment of our society, and we shouldn't let ourselves be driven by the extremes.
There's a group called Emily's List that supports women for office, but almost always Democrats.
Right.
Is there something about women, and most people assume that women are more likely to vote for Democrats than Republicans. Would that have, why didn't that affect you when Bob Dole asked you to be his running mate? Wouldn't you have had added something to that ticket?
Oh, he didn't ask me to be his running mate. No, we never did. I mean, I
you asked yourself to be taken off the short list.
Well,
which
I don't think I was ever on a short list, so that was an easy request to make. No, it would have been an honor to have been asked to stand for the vice presidency but you know, it was not something that was ever a reality. But we also have Wish List on the Republican side that does the same thing as Emily's, and those are each partisan and support women candidates. And we do need more women in high public office. When you look at the globe and you look at the societies that have had women leaders and the fact that many of those cultures, India, Israel, the United Kingdom, don't necessarily promote women's equality all the way through their society, and yet they've had women leaders. And here in the United States, with our education level, with our wealth, we still have yet to have a woman seriously. I mean, we had Geraldine Ferraro, and since she ran for vice president, we haven't seen another woman on the ticket.
It's kind of shocking when you think that Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, India, countries where there's been absolutely no feminist movement,
right,
have all had women,
Pakistan. As
my guest is Christine Todd Whitman. Her book, It's My Party Too, A Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. It's published by the Penguin Press. How did George W. Bush come to select you to lead the EPA? You were the governor, still governor of New Jersey at the time. Were you happy with the job?
Oh, yeah, I love the job, but he knew I was in my last year. I was term limited. He and I had served together as governors. We had co-chaired the convention the 4 years before, and we'd gotten to know each other. And I presume because of my record on environmental issues in New Jersey, he felt that I could help the administration.
Hadn't you cut the budget and restructured the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection?
I had restructured it. We finally, let's see, about 2% loss in numbers of employees, but the record on even the most recent Democrat administration had to say that industrial pollution during my time as governor went down 58%. We saved more open space than under any previous governor. We were able to see beach closings reduced from over 900 the year before I took office to 12 the year I left office. You know, the way that's part of the problem that I've always had with how we look at environment. We've always measured success by how many regulations have you promulgated, how many fines fees, how much in fines, fees, and penalties have you collected. Not is the air cleaner, the water purer, the land better protected, people living healthier lives. That's what it should all be about. And so we need to take another look, and we did very well on the environment.
As a governor, you were on the receiving end of the EPA's directives during the Clinton administration.
Yes.
What did you think of the way the federal government was overseeing the environment at that time?
Well, obviously, I had seen the instances of overreach, what I thought were overreach. I'd seen problems. I was part of the Northeast Coalition that brought suits under the New Source Review Act against the Environmental Protection Agency
to encourage self-regulation,
to encourage more regulation of the Western power plants. But I also, and it was something we did at the state level, saw the opportunity to try to be a little more progressive and allow a little more flexibility for businesses to go beyond what was being required by regulation, provide some incentives. There's nothing wrong with profit. And we did that successfully in New Jersey, and I believe that it could happen at the federal level as well.
The environment hadn't been a key issue in the 2000 campaign. President Bush wasn't making it clear that the environment was one of his priorities. Did you think that the environment would be one of his big domestic policy priorities?
I knew he cared. And when we talked about it, I knew where he wanted to go, which was to that test that really measured outcomes rather than process, and a way to break this mindset that the environment is a zero-sum game, that you can't have a clean and green environment and a healthy, thriving economy. But I didn't ever think that it was going to be the top issue. I mean, the frustrating thing about the environment is if you ask people what their top issues are, top 10 issues, environment's never there. You give them 15 and you say, you know, pick your top 10, maybe environment's 9 or 10, but everybody cares about it. I think it's because they assume it's complicated. I personally can't do much about it. And my water's clean. My air's okay. We have parks around us that they don't get as involved as they could or should in it.
So let's talk about clean water. One of the first controversies you faced was a Clinton administration regulation that lowered the acceptable level of arsenic in drinking water. Were you surprised by the reaction you had when you changed that?
Oh, I was staggered because I didn't change it. What I did is I said, I want to hold it up until we've had another chance to look at the economic implications of it, the cost-benefit analysis, which staff was telling me they had not had time to do because this regulation was rushed out at the end of the Clinton administration, and they'd stayed working over Christmas and New Year's to get it out, hadn't been able to do all the work that they wanted to do on it. And I had scientists telling me that anywhere between 25 parts per billion standard and 5 parts per billion was probably okay. Now, that has huge implications for the number of utilities that get caught up in it and, money and all the rest of it. So what I said was, we'll be on the same time schedule as the Clinton administration regulation and implementation. We will lower the standard. We will lower the what's acceptable as amount of arsenic in water from where it was at the time. But I want to take a second look at the to make sure we're in the right place. And the reaction was so extreme, and it went so far beyond anything that was justified by fact, that I was really amazed.
Eventually, you did lower the
Oh, we did, and we did levels. It to the same level that had been proposed by the Clinton administration. But they still, I saw Al Gore said something, even though we'd done that, saying we tried to lower, we tried to increase the amount of arsenic that was acceptable in water. That never happened.
Another legacy of the Clinton administration was the Kyoto Protocol. What did the protocol aim to do?
Well, the protocol is aimed really at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It doesn't go at the intensity of greenhouse gas currently in the atmosphere, but after emissions. And the Clinton administration had negotiated the protocol and the treaty and had taken the idea up to Capitol Hill. It was voted down by the Senate 95-0. And every year after that, the Senate and the House put provisos in appropriations bills and said no part of the federal government can ever spend any money on anything that looks like it's implementing Kyoto. So Kyoto was never going to pass in this country. When the president disengaged from it, he was really just saying the emperor has no clothes because the Clinton administration never took it back. They never fought for it. They knew it wasn't going to win. And the president said, look, this isn't going to solve the problem. If you don't include China and India, two of the fastest growing countries starting to emit. China will very shortly be emitting more than we do as a nation. You have to include them in it, and the hit to our economy would be too great. But he still said, I want to reduce greenhouse gas intensity by 18%. He's spending more money on climate change research and technology development than we've ever spent before, and he's engaged internationally. It was the way we did it that sent an incorrect message, I guess is the best way to phrase it.
Well, you went to a meeting of your G8 counterparts in March 2001. Mm-hmm. And what was their reaction to all of this?
Well, they had heard during the campaign that the president was not supportive of Kyoto, and I hadn't supported the Kyoto Treaty either. So there was already skepticism about what the administration would be doing. But because the president had called for a cap on carbon during the campaign, and I went to the White House before I went over to Trieste and said, I want to talk about this because that's one of the most easily identified of the greenhouse gases, carbon. Everybody said, fine. And when I did it, that gave them some reassurance. Okay, so it won't be Kyoto, but there'll be something that does address greenhouse gas emissions. And they felt better about it. Of course, when I got back was when there'd been this enormous push from the Hill saying, you can't do this to the president. And, of course, we had the California energy crisis, the fact that we're 53% dependent on coal for our power source, and that's the biggest emitter of carbon, a whole host of reasons why the president decided to change his mind.
In fact, we received almost as much criticism for that from certain allies as we did later when we went into at war in Iraq.
Oh, yes. It's a big issue for the rest of the world.
You say that the president was under no obligation to take the advice of his cabinet, but you had to have been frustrated. Do you think that the United States will ever commit to reducing carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, the president already has. He's called for an 18% reduction in greenhouse gas intensity over the next 10 years. He is spending, as I said, it's now up to over $5 billion on climate change technology and research. He is engaged with almost all of the developed countries around the world in different aspects of this. The administration is playing a role here. They do recognize the importance of climate change. It is not the kind of mandatory, hard and fast mandatory role that many people would like to see, but they are playing a role in this.
An article in today's New York Times says that you perform, I'm quoting, some astounding contortions to avoid criticizing the president himself when we're talking about environmental issues.
Well, you know, this book was not about the president. It's not a critique of the president. It's a critique of the party and where it's going. It really is looking to the future. And again, you know, I'm dead honest when I say I can understand the president as a governor had a different field of vision. And then in that, as part of that, he put a cap on carbon. When he became president and he looked at the energy crisis in California, he looked at the commitment that the utilities have to coal. He knew that if he put a mandatory cap with any kind of tight time frame, that they the utilities, would suddenly need to and start to try to get more oil and gas, more exploration, more importation, neither of which we're willing to have. He looked at it from a different angle, and I could appreciate that.
Didn't you sit in on the Energy Task Force
Yes.
that was led by Vice President Dick Cheney?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we'll ever find out what happened during those meetings?
Well, during our meetings, there was never anybody there but other cabinet and administration officials.
You weren't
who
there
he
when
met
the
with,
industry people were
have he had individual meetings with. But, you know, I still think that is really a red herring, because what should matter is, what does the plan look like? What does the proposal look like? He could have sat down with the green groups every single day, smiled and nodded, and then paid absolutely no attention to them, and they would have felt better because they'd had the meeting, but it wouldn't have changed the policy. It's the policy you should care about, and it was always going to be subject to congressional debate, so it was going to be public.
Another early debate was whether the government would allow drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, which the president had discussed on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
How involved were you in those discussions?
Those were really with Interior and Energy. The Environmental Protection Agency would have only been involved if the decision had been made to go forward, and then it would have been to ensure that it was a minimal impact, adverse impact on the environment, or to make sure it actually could meet environmental standards.
Why did you leave the EPA after 2.5 years?
My husband and I really didn't like living in separate places. We actually like each other. And that was the reason for it. The timing was because there were some decisions coming down that I'd been working on for 2.5 years, and ones that I felt pretty strongly about, and they wasn't going to come out where I thought we needed to be. And, hey, I wasn't elected. It was the president, his policy. So that's what I left, so that he could have someone there who could sign those regulations with great comfort.
Can you imagine going back into politics?
I don't see it, no.
Meanwhile, you hope that your party changes, and that is what your book is about. It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America, published by the Penguin Press. My great thanks to Christine Todd Whitman for being my guest today. And by the way,
thank you.
If you want to know more, there's a website, www.myparty2.com.
Great. Thank you.